So this is intended to be a discussion on infrared effects, quantum effects, in De Sitter space. So there are a lot of things that one could say here, and I don't know how far I'll get through this, but just to give you some basis, well, basically, I put on the wiki page for the non-equilibrium program two references. One of them is a review article myself and collaborators. And a second, this contains many references. And a recent paper by Sasha Polyakov, which raises some of these very same issues again, and this is on the archive, originally posted around September, and then a second version in December. So we've been discussing this sort of on and off here, and it seemed like it might be an interesting thing to go over these issues again. Some of them are actually quite old. These references contain things like papers that I wrote in 1985 when I was a postdoc here. And so some of that is well known, maybe some of it isn't well known. So I thought maybe we should sort of start from the beginning, and we'll see how far we get. So it is a discussion, though, so let's please interrupt me. So, of course, why do you care about the space? Well, it's basically because, well, one would like to understand the cosmological constant, or now we have a more fashionable phrase called dark energy. Okay, so as you all know, if taken at face value, the supernova data suggests that something like 70% of the energy in our universe is, in fact, dark energy, with rho lambda equal negative pressure. Okay, so one has actually reasonable bounds on this now from the data. It's still, of course, up to further observations to confirm this, but taken at face value, we actually live in something that's not so far away from De Sitter space. So that's another reason to think about this. If you take the data at face value, 70% of the closure density means this in Hubble units. This is the present value of the Hubble expansion time. And of course, what is 70% of the Hubble scale ends up being about 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. So if you worry about hierarchies, this is, of course, the biggest hierarchy problem of them all. So let me start by making a few comments just about vacuum energy, because, of course, you can think of this, and this, you know, has a fascinating history, which I'm sure someone who has looked at the history of physics could make a very interesting talk about that all by itself. You know, it goes back to Pauli's observation that if you took the zero-point energy of quantum theory seriously, that you would, of course, expect a vacuum energy roughly like the number of degrees of freedom and integration over momentum times the vacuum energy for each mode. And of course, this is very badly divergent and leads to something which goes like the number of degrees of freedom over some minimum. If I cut this off at some 1 over L min, then this behaves like a fourth power of 1 over L min. So this means that you have, in the naive calculation in flat space, extreme sensitivity to the ultraviolet. Although we should point out from the very beginning that this is not something that we measure in ordinary physics. So the best example of vacuum fluctuations in the laboratory is the Casimir effect. And you all know the famous calculation of Casimir of two conducting plates, which are a distance of d apart. And of course, you don't find a diverging energy here. Well, you do if you do it naively, but you have to be more careful and subtract that. And what you find is a much smaller effect, which is this famous 1 over d fourth. So notice what happened, that when you actually do the calculation with correct boundary conditions and subtract off the formally divergent energy of the vacuum, you get a perturbed vacuum energy due to the boundary conditions of the plates, which is in which this ultraviolet scale, L min, is replaced by the infrared scale of the plates themselves. And of course, this is small, finite, and measurable. So already suggests at this very naive level that one should not be thinking about this divergent quantity, but one should be thinking about deviations from that quantity depending on the conditions you're in the universe. Okay, so that's just a remark to get going. So now let's think about, basically this shows that these measurable effects are infrared effects, right? The scale D is macroscopic. It can be as big as you want. Of course, if it's too big, you're not going to see the effect, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with ultraviolet cutoffs. Okay, so that's one way to think about why infrared effects.
Kimmel,
yeah?
What about the scale of the weak scale, right? I mean, in some sense, the weak scale is a perturbation like D, at which something happens that generates that energy. So is the weak scale an infrared effect or a UV effect in your decision?
I would say it's an UV effect. Because
it's not negligible because it's playing the role. Something happened at the weak interaction time that had energy.
Yeah, so you have to calculate. So if you want to look at the expansion of the universe as you go through that scale, of course, there's going to be a change in the vacuum energy at that scale.
Yeah, the weak interaction vacuum is still non-trivial.
Yeah, if n changes, of course, then you have the number of degrees of freedom change.
No, it's not a question of number of degrees of freedom. I mean, we don't see that they're not present at low energy, but they're virtual. I think what you're implying is that the virtual effects of Higgs's don't contribute to the vacuum energy that we see. They're not infrared.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
This is
good. Wrong, right? Phenomenologically. Okay, so you can take that as a.
There's another way of viewing the Casimir fraction, which makes the dependence of the distance between the plates much more apparent. You can equally run a calculator at this point.
That's right. Here. That's we're never going to get to anything like that here.
Yeah,
so,
but one should remember that the reason
correct.
That long-range forces has to do with the fact that there are indeed
right.
long-range forces in nature, which are electrical forces that are given rise
to. Everything, I absolutely agree. And in that case, everything's under physical control, and you can look at it exactly as the induced dipole-dipole interaction.
Infrared effects are just a natural scale of the
I don't want to argue about misleading, but it is certainly a fact, right, that this force has nothing to do with any ultraviolet cutoff. That's the only statement I want to make. Okay. So, great. We're going to have a lively discussion. So, okay. That's the point, right? But I do want to try to get to what I think are the main issues. So we'll see how it goes. All right. So let's talk now about the sitter space. Okay. So this is all familiar stuff, but basically there are several different ways of writing the sitter space in different coordinates. So this is one you often see because it's nice. It has spatially flat sections, and so you can do a lot of your standard stuff there. Inflationary people, for example, like that. But it's not so great in the sense that it covers only part of the manifold. The H here is, of course, this is the Robertson-Walker scale factor. I'm using T bar here because I want to reserve T for a different time. So, of course, this is just solving the Friedman equation with a vacuum energy proportional to lambda. This is just lambda over 3, okay, where I put C equal 1. Okay, so this is one version of Friedman, Robertson, Walker coordinates. Another version, which is exactly the same line element, and I'll call it tau now. So I just want to write down some formula so we don't lose track of what we're talking about. So this exhibits the spatial sections as three spheres. So the sitter is actually, that's a poor diagram, isn't it? The sitter is actually a hyperboloid of revolution. So it's a space of constant positive curvature with my conventions, and is each slice at tau equals constant is a three sphere. Okay, so that's what this picture is meant to represent. Time, tau, time is going up this way, slicing through these three spheres. Okay, so that's one way of writing it. There's another way of writing it, and I just want to record this, is in a static coordinates. You'll see why this is relevant, I hope. But here I call it T. So here, these are two spheres, and here this exhibits the horizon, the fact that there's a certain, if the observer is put at r equals 0, he has an apparent horizon at 1 over h, which is just the statement that he's just sitting here, and basically light waves are from the other half of the space are unable to reach him. So finally, one can put this in a Penrose-Carter diagram like this, and this you'll find in all the books. So tau equals infinity is up here, and the slicings through at constant tau are just horizontal slices, but this time coordinate T runs like this here and only covers this one wedge, and in fact it runs backwards on the other side. So this is the time-like Hilling field d by dt. Okay, so that's just the geometry of the sitter space, which is very standard. Now what we want to talk about are quantum effects in this background. So I want to discuss quantum field theory in the sitter space. Now we're starting to get closer to some of the issues raised in these recent papers. So of course, as is well known in field theory in any curved space is not, there's no unique vacuum state, unlike Minkowski space where you have a well defined vacuum, which you can think of as being annihilated by positive frequency excitations. So what you'd like to do in a canonical treatment, right, is expand, say, a scalar field operator in some set of modes, labeled here just generically by I, and define a state which is annihilated by the annihilation operator I, AI. Yeah, for the moment. For the moment, but we're going to talk about interactions, hopefully, before we get on, because that's part of the point. Okay, so these are just solutions of the wave equation, of course. Let's stay with free fields for a moment. And the problem, of course, is that there are lots of ways, there are lots of solutions of the wave equation if you take this background as an example, but really in almost any background, you're going to have some decision to make about what are the fields you're going to call phi I and what are the phi I star. In other words, you don't know a priori what the positive frequency solutions are. Like you know in flat space, you're going to take in flat space this to just be e to the I omega p, where omega p is p squared plus m squared in flat space. And this basically gives you a unique decomposition into positive and negative frequencies and gives you a unique vacuum state. Okay, if you think of it in the canonical way. So, I haven't stated any, right? But sure. Sure. There are alternative ways of doing it, right? And you get the same answer. Yes. This is a canonical. Yeah. In principle, yeah, of course. Yeah. But that's just the point. You don't really know. You don't really know what to do here. Yeah. Okay. So that's. Well, that's what's going to be the next statement. Okay. So there is a. This space has a lot of symmetry. You know, I just want to say, in general, you don't have symmetries, right? So you don't really know what to do. And you know, we have a program here on non-equilibrium field theory, and the way one would approach it there is by some sort of initial value formulation in which you then evolve, because you don't necessarily, in any background, have particular symmetries, right? Now, in this space, of course, if we're trying to do quantum field theory in this space without any perturbations on it, then, of course, this space is a lot of symmetry. It's a hyperboloid of revolution. It's a solution of Einstein's equations in which the curvature is constant everywhere. So you can think of this embedding in a five-dimensional embedding space, and then you'll see that this hyperboloid just has a 041 symmetry group, which the one means one of the directions has to be time-like in the embedding space. This is a Lorentzian flat space embedding of hyperboloid. Okay? So, indeed, what is usually done, and it's called a bunch Davies, or kind of version of Hartle-Hawking vacuum, is to assume the symmetry. So forget for the moment about this, as you just said. One could do it that way, but one could also just demand that Green's functions, Whiteman functions, or in general Feynman functions, behave like, let's make this a Feynman function, are in fact 041 invariant. So So let me call this the Bunch Davies, or Polyakov calls it Euclidean. We can call it Euclidean as well. Okay, why Euclidean? Because the way you can define this most elegantly and rapidly is by continuing this one time-like direction to space-like one, and then instead of a hyperboloid, you have a sphere, a four-sphere. So under Euclidean continuation, the sitter hyperboloid becomes, I don't know what I should use for that, becomes a four-sphere, and the group, of course, is O5. Everything Euclidean then. And then you know how to calculate Green's functions on O5, right? On S4, you just basically demand that everything is a function of the invariant distance on the sphere. So you have two points, and you know that the geodesics are great circles, and you can basically require that this function be a function only of that invariant distance. And if you do that, that turns the second order equation for this Feynman function into an ordinary differential equation in terms of this variable. And there are two solutions, but you can pick out which solution by demanding that it have the right short distance singularity and no other singularity. Okay. So you can either do it by mode functions, or you can do it by this kind of geometric construction, and you get a well-defined function, which, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't bother to write down, but I will. So not surprisingly, when you're dealing with spheres, you're going to get Legendre functions, and this is just the particular Legendre function that satisfies the right equations and right boundary conditions, and gamma here is just something that depends on the ratio of the mass of the field to the Hubble radius, to H.
Just again,
vacuum state. Yeah. I'm trying to assiduously avoid using the word vacuum, but the state.
Yeah.
You're, right.
And that state is annihilated by all the generators of O4 Lama electrons, right?
Right.
That's
that's the group theory state you want to, right. Okay. Yes. Yes. I mean, there are other.
Any other possibility you're involved in a state that's not connected?
Or will involve additional singularities besides the usual short distance one.
I'm worried about the state.
Yeah, me too.
Green functions in that state have to do with other things. It's still construct the state.
Yes. Yes.
So will other alternatives involve states that are not invariant under the full connection?
Or
not more.
Yeah. No, the answer is not quite. No. No. Okay, so let me make the statement about Green's functions and then translate it to your language. Okay? As I said, if you demand just invariance, of course you get a second order equation for this Green's function, which always has two solutions. This is the unique solution which has the right short distance behavior. But you can have a second solution which has antipodal. Okay. Yes? We're not yet to transitions. We're not yet at transition elements, right?
But I'm doing quantum.
Free quantum field theory.
Well, more than one of fucking there might be. That would be great. And indeed, if we listen to your deep vacuum and find very rotations, or observability groups are bound to be many. In fact, maybe a continuous number. I just want to make it clear. I mean, I...
Now, Ron, what are you getting at?
I presume there is a common space in this discussion, otherwise I don't know what we're doing. Right? So you are talking about a state E, and they're generated with this group, which is right down in the particular field theory you have. Right? Does it or does it not? Are you demanding that state E invariant?
I am demanding it, but it is not the unique state which has that invariance. At the linearized level, if you just look at the generators. So you have these 10 generators for this group.
In 05, that's like the 05.
No, fine.
There. The question is, say that there's where with what properties.
Right.
If one knows the world, one can construct a Hilbert space and so forth. In the given Hilbert space that contains the 05 invariant state that Kendall has talked about, where frequently the linearized going, it is the unique 05 invariant state in that Hilbert space. The other 05 invariant states, what these things are called alpha vacua that you would have heard of from some years ago, they involve body shortness of properties, they're singular in other senses, they don't lie in the same Hilbert space, but you can talk about them as states in some more general sense. This is the technical issue that Kendall is...
I'm trying to not get deep into, but...
Also, there's discussion so far, maybe you're going to get to this. The discussion so far is very perturbative and culture.
It's free. So far.
Yeah. As far as you go, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Presumably, when you formulate the description of the states, you may well have to do that in a non-perturbative framework.
Well, we are. Some of the things that are raised, say, in the Polyakov paper are about perturbation theory. So we can address some of the questions in a perturbative framework.
Some of them, there's a related comment, and that is that so far, in the context of the big symmetries of gravity, you're not
No. No, this is a global symmetry, not local gauge invariant. I mean,
So one is not, one has to think about what the right gauge invariant quantities are, as well.
Sure. Good. Shall I continue? No, go ahead. No, tell me. I mean, there are so many points we can raise here and go in many different directions, so I'm happy to do that, but we may not then get to questions. So.
Well, I mean, if
okay. Well, gamma is real, as you see, if the mass is big enough, bigger than this critical value of 9/4. It's another question. If the mass is bigger than this value, so the gamma is real, everything is fine, and this is a well-behaved state. If you look at light fields, in which the mass is less than this, you have to be more careful. There are certain issues that arise with the massless limit. I'll try to talk about that. Right. Yeah. I mean, okay, so, yeah, I think... When gamma becomes imaginary, basically different representations of the group are involved. So these are the standard continuous representations of the group. But the fact that a number like this appears is telling you that this is a different group than you usually encounter, you know, the Poincaré group in flat space. You don't see any such kind of thing. And this is telling you something about the group theory representations of this non-compact group. So there is a continuous representations for gamma positive and real, and which are unitary and everything is good. If gamma becomes imaginary, you get other kinds of representations you have to be careful about. Yeah. All right. So good. Now, this is the state, of course, everybody uses. It has these good properties and seems very natural. So a number of us, I include myself in this, and more recently...
This is the one that Polyakov disagrees with, doesn't it?
Right.
You're not going to touch it.
Well, I think there's some issues. Okay, and that's what we're going to discuss. Okay, so there are so many issues that I didn't really quite know how to get at this, so I started to think about looking at an analogy, which I think is actually a pretty good analogy. And that is, so let's take an aside at the risk of losing you about the sitter space. I want to make an example, an analogy. And that is constant, uniform electric field. So now we're going to do QED, not gravity, okay? But there's a background field, E, which is a constant everywhere in space and time. Now that's, as you know, a perfectly good solution to Maxwell's equations in vacuum, so we can even push the analogy a little farther and ask ourselves why there isn't a big electric field here in this room of cosmological origin. Why is it that the only fields we see are local, coming from local charges? So if you
like,
for an abuse of language, I could call that the cosmological electric field problem. Very good question. It does. No, it turns out you can actually construct with a constant uniform field a 10-dimensional group, with 10 generators, which has the same structure as the Poincaré group. That's another mathematical aside.
Pure electromagnetism?
Yeah.
Because in pure electromagnetism, before you turn this on, you had not a 10-dimensional group, but you had a 15-dimensional.
Yeah, no.
So you've broken that down to 10 dimensions.
I mean, the Poincaré group.
550 to 10.
Well, here you don't have a conformal group either.
Just saying.
Yeah.
You're right. Start with a uniform electric field.
Yeah.
The 10 dimension is a right
10
group.
Right.
Symmetries.
Yeah.
It doesn't impress me because you started before you turned on DE with 50 generators.
But that's true here also.
No, in Kowski space and the sitter space.
The sitter space has five conformal.
The Poincaré group.
Yeah.
And the sitter space is invariant in the local one. There are 50.
No. No, it's five. It's 5 times 4 divided by 2. It's 10. It's 10 generators. There are 10 symmetry generators. There is no conformal group.
And there are 10 in the Minkowski.
There are 10 in the Poincaré group.
There are 10 and there are 10. You haven't lost them. Whereas here...
But you're counting the conformal...
Maxwell's equation.
If you count the conformal transformations, then I've also lost 5. It's exactly the same.
You haven't lost the... neither Minkowski space or, you know, massive... You were doing massive scalar field theory in Minkowski space.
Yeah. There wasn't any conformal invariance anyway.
We're spending a lot of time on. But I'm just saying, then you say, aha, I have Maxwell's equations to invariant Poincaré transformations, 10 parameters, and when I turn on an E, I don't lose any.
Right.
But I say you are losing something. You're obviously losing something. You're risk counting because when you have Maxwell's equations in flat space with no background fields, you had 15 generators.
For massive fields? Where's the
Maxwell's equation?
Maxwell's equations are conformal.
Yeah. Maxwell's
so
equations,
is,
yeah. But Einstein's equations are not conformal, right?
Okay.
Right. So I don't quite agree.
All I'm saying is, okay. You said turn on a background field.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm going to talk about quantum. I'm going to talk about quantum field theory in this background. So there is no conformal invariance. I think
so if, the reason you happened to find 10 generators,
turning on something which brings rotational invariance, brings that 15 down to 10.
Okay, Dave, I think we have to discuss. I think, I mean, there are five extra conformal fields, five extra conformal killing vectors, okay? But those are not symmetries of Minkowski space.
Why do you get four dimensions?
No. Why?
What? His claim was just swell in five dimensions.
Right.
His claim that you recover a Poincaré life.
Think what you're using. You're lost. What makes them up?
I
understand
the conformal variance. Where does that come from?
I don't know. That's right. It has nothing to do with conformal variance. That's right. I'm not going to write them down. I can go point them to you at some point if you want.
They're not contained in the 15-letter of the conformal book.
There's a deformation of the for any e. Yes.
Therefore, they must be contained in the 15-generator of the conformal group. Because they're contained in the generators of the symmetry group when E is equal to zero, right?
Minkowski space does not have a conformal symmetry group.
Do you have a symmetry which
this is
when E goes to zero?
No, it continuously deforms back to the usual one.
So it's made up out of some combination of generators of usual.
Yes, but I don't think that has to do with the conformal group. But conformal group, by the way, here is also 15 dimensional, right? There is a conformal group, which is 042, which is the same because it's a conformally flat space. Yeah. Yeah. But this is a technical point. Let's please have a timeout on that so we can go a little farther. So suppose I do quantum field theory in this case. Okay, I think this analogy is not completely distraction. It's actually worth thinking about a little bit, and it was something that I certainly thought about and influenced some of my thinking here. So suppose we now take a charge field scalar. Let's keep it simple and free, but it could be massive. And we now look at this equation. So again, in this language, if you think about mode functions, and I know you don't like that, but we can look at it many different ways. But I think this is one way to show canonically what's going on. So you can again look at expanding the field. Now it's just plane waves, and depending on the gauge. So for example, there are two gauges I can use. Right? I can use a time-dependent gauge, in which AZ, say, is a linear function of time, or I could use a static gauge in which there's no time dependence, but of course in this gauge I have a linear potential. By the way, that isn't so different from this situation either, where you can write things in a static way or in a time dependent way. So if I do it in this gauge first, then the second order equation this obeys looks like this. So this is just obviously a inverted harmonic oscillator potential. So you get a lot of intuition by just thinking about an inverted oscillator. T, this is a quadratic function of T. And so, and because of the sign, this looks like a potential that's inverted, and basically you're looking at scattering in which you're above the barrier because that's controlled by this quantity. So you know perfectly well what's going to happen, right? If you look at scattering at this energy level, you're going to be partially reflected and partially transmitted to the other side of the barrier, right? And in fact, if you define a positive frequency function, let's call it f in, to be that solution of this equation, which behaves like a positive frequency function since this is time dependent, I have to write this phase this way. So let's look at that function which behaves this way in, say, t goes to minus infinity, I call that fn, and likewise, I can look at the same limit, but as t goes to plus infinity, and I call that f out. Well, because of the reflection coefficient being non-trivial, not surprisingly, these two functions are not the same, but since it's only a simple second-order equation, they have to be linearly related to each other, and you can easily see, by just working with the special functions here, instead of Legendre functions, they're parabolic cylinder functions. But just by working with them, you'll find that there is a reflection coefficient parameterized by this beta, which means that at late times, the in vacuum contains negative energy particles in this sense, the complex conjugate wave function. And it's easy enough to work out the magnitude of this. Is this. So there is an exponentially small reflection coefficient if the electric field is weak, but non-zero. Then it's a simple exercise to say, okay, this is basically proportional to the probability of creating a pair out of the in state with respect to the out state. And so you can calculate by standard methods the overlap between out and in, and it's basically a product over the K. So I'll skip the steps. Like this, which you can promote upstairs to an exponent. And you can go take the continuum limit, in which K just put an infinite volume. And if you take that limit carefully, you'll get a factor of the volume. And the KZ, in fact, since this is independent of KZ, you have to also get a factor of the time from the KZ integral. So if you do this right, you get something which is proportional to the volume, the three volume, and the time. And you get, therefore, a finite rate. And that finite rate is easily calculated from this. So I'll just, it's a nice formula, so I'll just give it to you. Do this integral by sum. Expanding the log as a sum. Go through this detail just to show you this all is very explicit, and this you will recognize as Schwinger's formula for the decay rate for a scalar boson, charged boson, and electric field. He did it actually for the fermion case, so you don't have this alternating signs. And this can be interpreted, you see, as a semi-classical creation rate, where n is telling you the probability of creating one pair, two pairs, three pairs, etc., out of the vacuum. And you notice this nice logarithmic and exponential forms, which are very reminiscent of thermal field theory, in fact, because it looks like there's a certain thermal property here, which is the temperature, because, and indeed, temperature is essentially the acceleration over 2 pi. Particles are being uniformly accelerated here. So if I just naively replace that by this, then this, in fact, becomes a thermal-like factor. Okay, so again, it's similar to what you see in the Bunch-Davies state. Okay, so in fact, what I did years ago was the analog of this calculation for De Sitter, and not surprisingly, when you write down the wave equation in De Sitter space and you look at in the time-dependent gauge, say, in this set of coordinates, not too surprisingly, you find, again, a non-reflectionless potential. There are reflection coefficients, and you can calculate this thing. And by exactly the same arguments, get a formula like this. Where gamma is this gamma. Okay, so...
Interpretation of the instability is again creating...
pairs.
Quanta?
Yeah, pairs. So I'm also studiously avoiding the word instability because I'm sure that will open a whole discussion. But I mean, if I construct an in state this way, then it means that that in state has essentially zero overlap with the out state if I wait a long enough time. It has the same interpretation as in the electric field case.
If you did the same calculation for your quantum calculation, it's neutral.
Here, yes.
So what's the analog of the charge? In the
well, it's the energy momentum tense, so you can calculate the difference.
You have particles of...
It's the energy. Here, if you if you look at this now as a real time problem, not as an infinite scattering problem, but you start with some initial surface, of course, what you're going to find is the created particles are generating a current. Okay, and the current is in the direction of the electric field. So if I now try to look at back reaction, then there will be an equation like this. So the current is trying, at least initially, to decrease the electric field. This we studied in these initial value problems.
Because the electric field is about...
Yeah.
So... a cosmological constant.
Yeah. So, okay. You can calculate the change in the stress tensor between the in and out states, and there is a negative contribution to the cosmological term that way.
Electric field is a field, and the cosmological constant is a constant.
Well,
you can't. They're very different things in quantum field theory, and so it's a pretty hazy analogy. By field, I carry one over to the other.
Well, I mean, we have to rely on some analogies, right? Otherwise,
well, the constant fields are not a good analogy.
He's saying that the source of the field is being negative.
It's
going in the right direction.
You're saying the source is a term on the boundary that sources the field.
You know, Joe, there are many ways to think about the cosmological term, and some people have formulated it as a boundary condition.
Usually
you don't think of it that way.
The closest analogy to what you're saying for electric field is the Brown tidal volume expression, which is there to screen the cosmological constant in that sense requires not creating particles but entire membranes.
That's different. This is different.
For the Brown tidal volume argument, but that's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
But you're saying you get a negative contribution that you're going to interpret as...
Well, it goes in the same direction.
In this calculation, the field actually has no dynamics.
That's right. We want to talk about interactions.
In this calculation, you can take the electric field as a background constant. You think about the calculation, right? You're doing vacuum graphs with this insertion. The photons don't actually propagate.
No, not yet.
And there's no higher radiated correction.
Right, not yet.
To make the analogy direct, you need membranes, not particles. That is, in order to suffer something in the background.
That's a different matter.
Are you going to explain why there's a critical mass in the gamma?
Explain. That's a matter of the group theory of this group.
So, when a mass is too small, what happens?
We're going to talk about massless things too, I hope. That's the more severe. Just on this remark, at the risk of opening more cans of worms, I just point out that if you take the Friedman equation and the conservation equation and just differentiate this, one of Einstein's equations can be put in this form, so that, of course, if you have zero cosmological, if you have a cosmological term, P is equal to minus rho, and H is a constant. That's a perfectly good solution of the equations. However, if you create matter in which P plus rho is positive, then you would expect H to decrease in pretty much the same way as this equation tells you.
There's another objection around time, which I don't know if it applies to your model, but I'll mention it, which is up until very recently in our universe, the cosmological cluster was completely disguised by much larger non-vacuum energies.
Possibly, yeah, presumably.
It's the current one.
It's the current.
And so this process has to have been happening, you know, not in the distant past, but continuously,
Well, it's a question of time scales then. Yeah. Then it becomes and now we have to talk about interaction.
In Brown and Tenable, you miss the time scale by a huge, more than 10 to the 20.
Yeah. That's a question of time scale. And that's why I didn't make any. I think there's an interesting indication, but I wouldn't claim this solves the problem. I'm not claiming that. I'm just trying to show you that there are analogies that you can perhaps think about. And of course, if you're talking about spontaneous decay, you see, if you have massive particles and small electric field, this is exponentially suppressed. So the time scale is going to be enormous. Okay. However, gravitational coupling, you know, we can have massless particles in gravity. And so there doesn't necessarily have to be that effect. And that's one point. Second point is, this is a spontaneous creation rate. There, if you had any charges present in the initial state, then those are going to accelerate and produce an induced rate, which can be much larger because it can be proportional to the initial density. So just comments, okay? Not claims.
The time scale is what? Is this gamma?
That's the analog of this time scale, which is, by the way, for a massive field, you can just expand this, and this again becomes like a sum over n, some constants times e to the minus m over th, where th is the Hawking Disater temperature.
So there's also a massless contribution.
Yeah, for the mass, then this all these
questions.
At that time, I didn't consider it because there's a problem with going to zero mass here. Because then gamma becomes imaginary, and I can't really interpret these formulas.
But so you're saying what is canceling the energy density is just negative energy models.
It goes in that direction. It has the right sign. Okay? I haven't said it has the right magnitude or time scale.
So Bob is going to get case of that. I can think about this very as particles being funneling through this barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a particle here and I have a particle here and they created these guys get sort of far apart, they're like three particles.
Yeah, I mean, in free particle theory, it's not even sensible to talk about pressure, right? I mean, if you calculate the stress tensor.
Perhaps the stress tensor
is
zero.
I haven't claimed that yet. I mean, by the way, I should say here, even in this case, and this is one of the subjects of our things we talk about in this program, this is something you can do in the large N approximation, and we did those calculations. I was actually motivated to study these kinds of problems by the gravitational analog, and you find not the electric field going to zero, but you find plasma oscillations. Because you create particles, the electric field goes through zero, overshoots it, then the charges go back the other way. Okay, and it takes a long time for anything to damp out, and in fact, in this approximation, they're not damped.
You mean if you do it more in a realistic situation where the field is not uniformly polarized?
No, I mean if I just do it in this mean field approximation, in which I ignore photons and only talk about the mean value of the current. So what you need are the interactions with the electromagnetic fluctuations. Then you expect to get some finite conductivity. That's the only way you're going to get a real approach to zero, and even in this problem. That's a much harder calculation, of course. You're not going to get that in just this mean field picture. You have to put the interactions.
So you have some de Sitter excitation which you're going to produce.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about the massive case, the massless ones like graviton probably as well.
I want to talk about those.
And then those produce some expected stress tensor. And if you're able to calculate that, then you argue that
I think part of the motivation here was to connect with this recent paper of Polyakov. And I think about half of what Polyakov is saying boils down to this. Boils down to the fact that there are non-trivial mixing coefficients in the Sitter space.
That's just particle production.
That's, yeah. Well, he's what he is.
He's saying that wipes out the Sitter space.
Well, no,
much as particle production wipes out a constant field.
That additional step will be exciting.
Yeah,
particles, we know that.
I'm trying to go in something like a logical way. Okay, this is a first indication that there's some issue. Okay, that you may have to think about. And I think what Polyakov is saying. So let's talk about that.
You mentioned something about comparing the stress tensor in the in-vacuum and the out-vacuum.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to check, is that the same as saying that if you do what Steve was saying, you compute the expectation value of the stress tensor in the in-vacuum, and look at its time-dependent evolution at the initial part?
No.
Is it claimed that the expectation value of the stress tensor in the in-vacuum has a trace part which does in fact evolve, SOS would partially cancel out?
No, in the Heisenberg picture, the expectation value in the in-vacuum is just a constant.
No, the in-vacuum is not SO4 in your end,
Okay, there may be transient effects, but it just goes to a constant. Yeah, that's not the right calculation to do.
That's the calculation I wanted to ask
you about. So these are indications, okay? I'm certainly not claiming that this is a solution, okay?
Since this involves a discussion, I want to raise an issue which I hope you'll be able to return to later, which is particle production is controlled by H, the Hubble constant.
Yes.
The Hubble constant is down by the vacuum energy by 2 powers of the Planck mass.
Mm-hmm.
That's the statement that gravity is an irrelevant interaction.
Right.
Many attempts to understand the cosmological constant run around on just this feature,
mm-hmm.
that any feedback is suppressed relative to the thing needs to cancel by 2 powers, basically, of the lambda scale of the Planck scale.
For matter fields.
This is the general principle, that Hubble is much smaller than lambda. Any effect whose scale is
Hubble is smaller than lambda. Hubble is lambda.
No. This Planck mass is in there.
There's no Planck mass here.
You're right. Lambda. Hubble is smaller than vacuum energy.
That's right. That is a factor of G Newton.
Hubble is smaller than vacuum energy. I'm being careless. And so any Hubble size. The question is, how can any effect whose size is set by the Hubble scale cancel something when you set by this much larger scale, the vacuum energy?
Fair question. That's saying that this is h to the fourth, not h squared.
Yeah, in units of Planck.
Okay. So, let's see. I want to make one more point about the electric field, and then this is great. Interesting discussion. But I think the
question of massless particles
and what Polyakov is saying is interesting as well. So, just one more statement. And maybe this will be provocative as well. Of course, this calculation is done in a particular way in which you assume some initial data and then look at the final data by these adiabatic-like conditions. I didn't have to do that, right? I could have defined a different state. We talked about group theory, but forget group theory for the moment and just think in this canonical picture. It's obvious that the only gauge invariant quantity here is an electric field, which is constant and uniform in time and space. That's time reversal invariant, right? The electric field is T even. So it's pretty clear I could have constructed a state which is also time reversal invariant. If it's time reversal invariant, it can't possibly have a decay rate. Indeed, there is a Euclidean calculation you can do, because by analytically continuing the electric field in any gauge you like to Euclidean time, you can write it in a way that looks like a magnetic field, right? Just that F dz can go to F tau z with a factor of I. Okay? And I know very well, right, you know very well, that a constant uniform magnetic field doesn't create particles, and you can construct a well-defined vacuum state for that, a Euclidean vacuum.
Yeah, but don't you have a different topology then? It's not as foreign anymore.
But here we're talking about the electric field.
Right.
Flat space.
Yeah, but we're talking about...
No topology. Okay. So this is the last point I want to make about the electric field case. So there is, in fact, a Euclidean vacuum. Now, we can argue about, you know, what Hilbert space it lives in, but clearly by a Fock representation, I can construct it. Okay? And in that state, there is no decay rate, and it's a completely time-reversible invariant. So that is indeed, I would claim, the analog of the Bunch-Davy state. It is, however, not usually thought that the existence of that state means that a constant electric field is stable.
Since you raised this question, I might mention that if you write group theory, that state is not time translation invariant. Of course, there is a time translation invariant state in the same Hilbert space you're using, which is just the one where the electric field is already decayed and the space is filled with positrons and electrons.
Yeah. You mean the ordinary vacuum? Yeah, but then we're talking about a fixed electric field without the back reaction, right? So just like a fixed de Sitter without any lambda. I mean, that has lambda, right? So.
My point is that E is not time translation invariant in this context.
Yes, it is. It's time reversal.
It's not time translation invariant.
It is. It's constant.
No, your Euclidean vacuum state.
I think it is. I think it is.
No, it's going to have particle production in both directions of time.
Yeah, in just such a way that all correlators are time invariant.
You're saying two different things. It's time reversal invariant, yeah. It's not time translation invariant.
I think I don't know off the top of my head. We can check that.
It should be time translation.
Yeah,
it's the electric field.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, there's no need to break the time translation symmetry either. The background is time translational invariant. So, I don't need to break time translational invariance in order to construct the state in Hilbert space. It may look time dependent, but that shouldn't worry me. So there is an analog of Bunch-Davies here.
That's something like where you have a flux of particles coming in infinity that you provide.
Yeah, exactly. I fine-tune, if you wish, or I arrange just the right flux to be coming in here so that with the reflection coefficient as it is, it's the same flux going back. So there's sort of detailed balance between the left and right sides of that potential. Looks a little artificial, but... Since free field theory, you can do almost anything, and no one can tell you that that's a wrong state to use. The only thing you could do, and it looks kind of strange, but that's because you have intuition about electric fields that you don't have about the Sitter space, particularly. But
there's another. So let me ask a different question.
All right.
I mean, in this case, we actually know how to create adiabatically construct such a state. You think because we can start with flat space, turn on the electric field in the finite region, and make that then region as big as we want. And that's an adiabatic. So what happens if I take the vacuum in flat space and do that adiabatically? Which of these possibilities?
Oh, I think you'll find the particle creation. If you turn the field on and off slowly, then you'll find particle creation.
You won't be fine-tuning that flux.
Yeah, because that will pick a certain boundary condition and will rule out this Euclidean boundary condition.
That's, so, you know, But that's okay. You were saying at some point I adiabatically turn this on. At some point it starts to decay. I find it actually impossible to go beyond.
Yeah, except that rate. That rate's different.
Well, that's examined because yeah. I can always make E as small as I want.
Yes.
But as I turn it on, there's a volume, a maximal volume I can get to any E.
Yeah, it's important here also that's long.
If I make E smaller and smaller as I make the volume bigger and bigger, there should be some adiabatic wave.
Yeah, there is.
And which will it approach
this? It will approach this. Yeah. I mean, there are various things in the literature.
At
yes.
point, it's going to be time reversal.
No. If I'm turning it on, I'm breaking time reversal. And turning it on, then.
Yeah. But it's not that I can arrange it always so it doesn't decay by making that field weaker and weaker.
But your data, the way you're turning it on is explicitly breaking time reversal invariance and time translational invariance. Even though slowly, you're still breaking it.
You're just saying the decay rate is very slow because E is very you take an E to be very small, so the decay rate is very slow.
You can see the point. I mean, the finite volume, then you can make it stable if E is.
If you have a mass gap, you're obviously protected. Because it takes a finite energy to pop them out of the vacuum.
So I can make it bigger and bigger. So any region, no matter how big, I can always create a constant electric field.
Sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Remains stable.
Yes.
For a while.
Sure.
This you of course.
You have enough potential.
Yeah, of course. Of course, you need the distance between the pairs as they pop out to be comparable to the mass.
Right. At this point, this is very similar to just discussing deforming the Hamiltonian quantum mechanics that takes a bound state in resonance. Right. And so, yeah. You can imagine doing that adiabatically, and the direction in which it continues into the complex plane is really dictated by the direction of time you put into your adiabatic deformation.
Yeah, you'll never avoid that. That will create a certain definite state. You won't have any choice if you turn it on, right? You'll produce a state.
State
will be not quite, but closer to this with some decay rate than the Euclidean state. I mean, the state will have transient effects, which is not this infinite time
calculus. The finite volume one, with volume less than given by this bound, will
decay. The finite volume, I'm right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you have an electric field and a size that's less than 2m, I guess. Then you can't create any particles.
But in the end, you solve a stationary problem, and then you set up the boundary conditions that give you certain physical interpretation, and you can reverse those boundary conditions in time. So the specific that there are no particles in the past and they appear in the future is just a boundary condition.
Exactly, or an initial condition, if you wish. Correct? Okay.
So I would say that
the only way to resolve, you know, if you knew nothing about what really happens, and of course this is a hard thing to observe experimentally, you have to do something like that adiabatic switching, or if you decide you like this state because it has the most symmetry, you can look at perturbations of that state by interactions, by linear response. That's a very well-defined thing, right? This state has zero current. Okay, so it's a perfectly good solution of the vacuum Maxwell equations. But then I could perturb the vacuum Maxwell equations and calculate the perturbation of this current. In other words, look at fluctuations around this vacuum. And then, of course, I'm going to get the polarization tensor. This will be the retarded polarization tensor if I do it properly with the initial conditions. So now I'm talking not about the mean value, but about the fluctuations around the mean value from this current-current fluctuation. So this is one way to address what happens. Of course, another way, this is kind of universal because whatever you do, you have to couple to the electric field. That's part of the setup. Whereas you could also introduce particle self-interactions, matter self-interactions, lambda phi fourth, and you could ask how that behaves. Okay. So, but
is that violated in the second you say?
What?
Polarization, because I'm just worried about the limitations and the extra eyes and so forth, and the divergence of place.
Oh, well, this will have the standard short distance singularities, but that's all. Well, you have to also look at what its long distance behavior is, because you've essentially set up a funny problem here with these boundary conditions. Yeah. In fact, I suspect, I haven't done that calculation, but I suspect that this thing will have long-range correlations that shows up as a divergence in frequency space. And that's, of course, the point. Because if there is such a infrared divergence in this object, then the solutions of this equation will blow up. They will be diverging in time. So that's telling you, if you carry that through and that's the result, that's telling you this state exists, but it's not anything like the real physical state you're going to produce, okay, under perturbations. Okay, so I do want to say now. So now I'm going to turn back to De Sitter space. So about half of Polyakov's paper, thereabouts, is, as far as I can tell, basically making remarks. Here I've done it in gory detail for you, but basically making remarks that are essentially equivalent to this, that you have particle creation in De Sitter space. This is the electric field case, but the De Sitter case is similar. There's a different potential and different scattering coefficients, but there is a non-trivial scattering of in-to-out states. And in fact, if I come back here, this P nu in this equation is in Polyakov. This thing has two pieces. So if you look at this at large z, for example. So the z, remember, is some measure of the invariant distance in De Sitter space. And so this, you can just see, basically corresponds to both positive and negative frequency components. Okay? He also phrases it in the language of sort of single particle Green's functions. Basically, if you look at single particle Green's function in flat space, you expect to have some weighted integral over the path length, right? You can always write the Green's function this way, and the length between two points. And of course, the Minkowski vacuum has this single frequency. It doesn't have any part of the complex conjugate. So the fact that you have these things means, you know, non-analyticity, and usually the usual propagator, that's the meaning of the I epsilon prescription, is that it's analytic in the lower half complex plane in M squared. Okay, that's why you do Euclidean continuation. So here, Euclidean continuation geometrically produces a propagator without that analyticity. Without the analyticity in the mass, that, which is actually the reason you do that in flat space field theory.
So this is still gamma real.
Still gamma real, yeah.
So what happened to gamma?
You want to know, I know, and yeah, we're coming. Okay. So, and I think this is a nice observation, which is in Polyakov's paper. He says that in flat space, I can mock up this situation by just considering, so I have to erase something, by just considering a populated state. The reason, of course, you have positive and negative frequencies is because this is not a vacuum state with respect to those adiabatic modes, right? It has both positive and negative frequencies. That's the way you've arranged it in order to have these nice Euclidean properties. So suppose I look at a populated state. People in this program know this very well, that if you look at, say, the Fourier transform in spatial momentum of the Green's function of a populated state, just an ordinary flat space now, you'll get a term which is like this. where this is the distribution function, and you'll get another term like that. So that is exactly the kind of situation we're talking about here, where you have both positive and negative frequencies. And if you try to calculate a Feynman-like amplitude, okay, for scattering, you now start to think about interactions, you're going to get into trouble, because you're going to get terms where this phase factor cancels that phase factor in intermediate integrals, and therefore the intermediate integrals will not behave properly. So he focuses on the composition rule. Normally you would say that the Feynman propagator should obey a composition rule like this. And of course it does if I have only one frequency, because basically I just take the product of two things like this, and then it's just the total length integrated over. If I put in an intermediate state here, or intermediate time, then basically in the Feynman integral I'm just summing over the amplitudes to go from here to there and there to there. So this works. Of course, as soon as I have this composition, as soon as I have non-trivial distributions here, this won't work, because what I'll find are cross terms between these two kinds of terms, and in fact the integral over the intermediate time, let's call it ty, will diverge. Integral over ty diverges and is proportional to f 1 plus f. So if f is 0, you don't see that problem, but as soon as you have particles in the state, you do. Okay. But that's, I think, has a standard, well-known interpretation, right?
What? Integral over ty is f plus times the time.
Yeah, times the time of integration, so it's formally infinite. Of course, we don't expect a scattering matrix to exist in a state in which there are particles everywhere distributed in momentum space. I mean, finite temperature theory, you don't have a scattering matrix because the particle can interact with the thermal bath. It never escapes to infinity. It never produces an asymptotic state. So we know how to deal with that. We don't look at Feynman amplitudes. We look at the Schwinger-Keldysh closed time path amplitudes, which means that you have to talk about a matrix of Green's functions, which is, let's call this one G++, that has the Feynman I epsilon prescription, G minus minus, which has the minus epsilon prescription, and then the Whiteman functions, depending on which field I put first, plus minus and minus plus. So when you do that, of course, you don't, this is not a natural object at all, and if you talk about scattering now in real time, you're going to get additional terms coming from these off-diagonal matrix elements, and you'll get something which is like G++, G++, minus terms like this. Okay. And now when you integrate over time, this is finite. It's just telling you that you're not calculating a matrix element for S matrix, you're calculating some kind of in expectation value, and that's what these boundary conditions and the Schwinger-Keldysh stuff is about. Okay, so... No. This is true. So this was just about populated states in ordinary free flat... Yeah, okay. So basically, this tells you you don't have an S matrix. As soon as you have a population, as soon as you have a non-trivial component in the other complex, which is what's characteristic of this vacuum,
which is
like a thermal state, right? So he makes those observations. Those are all correct.
However, you know,
Right.
And so why? And you'd think that in the Euclidean world, I had a well-defined path integral.
Mm-hmm.
There, this inclusion property would be automatic.
It is indeed in the Euclidean, but once you analytically continue, you've gone to a non-compact manifold, and everything is different.
Excuse me, what convolution is automatic in Euclidean? I mean, if I have one particle quantum mechanics, that's one thing, but in field theory?
No, the statement is that if you take the product of two Euclidean, of course it doesn't have the interpretation of a scattering amplitude, but if you take the product of two Euclidean Green's functions, they will obey formally this kind of composition rule. Yes, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. But that's that's a fact, but of no relevance, I would say, in Euclidean space. Yeah, I mean, because you want to talk about composition rules, you want to talk about real time, right? And then, so it is an amusing and true fact that the Euclidean continuation, which really is based on this I epsilon prescription of M, produces a propagator that doesn't have the properties you might expect. Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. Well, it's one way of thinking about it, right? So you have to give up something. That's the moral. Something is, you either have to give up your analytic properties of the propagator, or you have to do something time dependent.
Well, it sounds, at this point, it sounds to me like you made very good arguments against the propagator.
Really? Okay. I'm happy if you think so, but I am sure we'll have defenders.
What are the arguments for Bunch-Shapers?
Let's let Emil tell us why this is a problem for Bunch-Shapers.
Well, I think it's really
I don't think he has.
No, I was trying to connect with Paul. I mean, I think most of what Polyakov is saying is this.
So are you going to repeat Polyakov's next comments, or should I?
We'll talk about massless fields next. That's been...
Okay,
but go ahead. What do you want to say? This is just massive fields.
I agree. Right. So this is a good place for me to...
Go ahead. Jump on in. It's a discussion.
So Polyakov comments that, indeed, this means that the S matrix is divergent and will define the consider space.
Mm-hmm.
This is a known fact.
Yes.
With the Bunch-Shapers state.
With the Bunch-Shapers state, if you like. Yes. Treating the bunch... In other words, if you think about trying to do a problem where you adiabatically turned off an interaction in the past, started the state in the Bunch-Shapers vacuum of the free field, turn on the interaction in the future, let run for a very, very long time, and you ask what comes out, there's a divergent S matrix in that sense. People often say that the language is confusing because I'm about to use the term outstate and instate, which mean very different things than over there. If you consider outstates and instates in this sense, meaning the state defined relative to, if you like, the Bunch-Shapers vacuum of the free field theory that might live in the far past or the far future, you turn the interactions on. But the scattering matrix is convergent. Great. That might lead you to conclude that, well, it's interesting to Polyakov that the theory is unstable in some sense. So let me mention that in the case of massive fields where gamma is real, there is nevertheless a well-defined version of perturbation theory that you can calculate that is in fact IR finite. It is not divergent. It merely, and it goes like this. If instead of trying to compute the S matrix, if you're trying to compute the Heisenberg picture field operators by perturbation theory, again, have this picture, you turn off the coupling in the past and the future, and you try to calculate a field operator in that interacting region in terms of the asymptotic free fields in the past or the future by perturbation. Those intervals converge, and that's all IR finite.
Great. It's like doing calculations of the double back.
Just like doing calculations of the double back.
Yeah.
And what you find is, of course, that if you look at the expectation value of a local field operator, then in fact, correlators of localized field operators, in fact, in the far, if you start the theory in this in the original Euclidean vacuum and the in Euclidean vacuum, and you correlate the local fields in the far future, which are not too far apart, then they return to their values in the Euclidean vacuum. So in other words, the local physics of De Sitter space is stable in one of these massive theories with a sizable mass gap.
Are you talking about free fields, or what calculation are you referring to? Just to be
clear,
lambda phi fourth.
For example.
Okay, because Polyakov does make a statement about divergences in lambda phi fourth, so you may have an opinion on that.
I don't, because
I haven't done that calculation.
Polyakov does not do this calculation.
Right.
This is the calculation I'm talking about is the analog of what you do with your math, or
he does the S.
He does the S metric. The S metric certainly diverges.
Right.
He's pointing out that the local physics is stable. The global physics has this divergence of the S matrix about it. So, from my perspective, I see nothing unphysical about this state you started with, this bunch state you started with. It's just that, indeed, one has to realize that there are, that because space is infinitely large, you do eventually produce an infinite number of particles, and it takes you to, in some sense, formally a different space.
So, what Polyakov discusses, I think, doesn't contradict what you said, is putting a lambda phi fourth interaction and trying to calculate basically an S matrix element of this, and this of course is divergent for the reason we said here. Okay. So yeah, everything factually correct.
Yeah.
The question is interpretation.
This is your defense of Einstein.
It's a fine state.
So it's a decent state.
It's a decent
which
state.
Perhaps should not call a vacuum state.
It's definitely
you can call it
vacuum.
You can call it what you like. It is a the Bunch Davies. You can calculate a Bunch Davies state being a Euclidean state for the interacting theory. Yeah, for that preferably. It's also a fine state. It is SO4-1 invariant, and it has correlators that can be calculated.
In something like Schwinger-Keldysh.
Yes, something like Schwinger-Keldysh.
No.
And for unlimited time.
No, we have to.
For unlimited time. Well,
the correlation functions are just well defined.
But in the case of this, with a large mass gap, there are no incorrect divergences. There's nothing that in principle
not this would apply. Not divergent in the vacuum.
Excuse me?
No, it's just an in vacuum. No, it's not in, it's just the Euclidean.
There are two things one can do. One can try to compute things in the Euclidean vacuum of the interacting theory, or one may compute something in.
Here's another box scheduled for this room.
1:30.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunate. It's not a bad place to stop, actually. Yeah. And I want to talk about massless fields and what's next, but we're not.
Next week.
The program coordinator is already complaining that I'm giving too many talks. Okay. Thank you.